half of the commentary search for me this morning. I should have called him sooner. Yeah. And speaking of laughter, I look over at John and there's no small child, and I thought, whoa, that didn't last long. We lost one, but he's in the nursery. Okay. I have a tendency to laugh at inappropriate times. I think I do it because I'm nervous, or I'm trying to cope, or I'm trying to understand things that are difficult. Not often, though, thankfully, yet, has God, you know, showed up and pointed out, you laughed when you weren't supposed to. So I say that sort of knock on wood. I mean, the day's still young, but. When Pastor Fred reached out to me asking if I'd be available for pulpit supply, he sent me the various lectionary readings for today. And after reading through the various texts, I thought, oh, that Genesis reading could be fun. There's a lot of interesting conversation around the three visitors and Sarah's laughter and the numerous iterations of how Sarah refers to her dear husband as old. But as usually is the case, I tend to get ahead of myself and bite off a little more than I can chew. And what I mean by that is, now I love looking through commentaries, I love reading articles and journals about biblical texts, and as a hospital chaplain, it's not something that I do all of the time. So this was kind of like recess for me. I got a break from my normal reading of healthcare journals, and I got to read about the Oaks of Mamre. But this particular text is a source of serious interfaith contention. Christians, we've read this story about Abraham and the three visitors, and we automatically think, ha-ha, this is one of the first scriptural sightings of the Trinity. And our Jewish siblings look at us and think, how in the world did you make that theological leap? I also read a Jewish interpretation that translates it, instead of God appeared to Abraham by the trees, it says God appeared to Abraham in the trees, which then sort of makes it sound like how God appeared to Moses in the burning bush. So this idea that God doesn't appear as a human, but God appears in and through God's own creation. Many hours have been spent poring over this particular passage, especially these three visitors and how and why they showed up the way they did. And I already confessed to you once today that I'm not a reverend, but I'm still here. My second confession today is I don't have any definitive answers about these visitors. I'm gonna do my best, but I also got sidetracked because, like I said, this was recess for me, so I was digging around and I wound up somewhere I didn't expect to be. But the thing about the three visitors, whoever they are, they didn't just appear to Abraham. They also spoke directly to Sarah. They were her guests as well. Now, we could go down another rabbit hole about the differences in how the visitors appeared to Abraham, making promises, sitting and having a meal with him, and then when they talk to Sarah, they're kind of wagging their finger at her. They snarked at her for laughing. But nevertheless, Abraham and Sarah together welcomed and offered hospitality to the three visitors. This meeting was a shared participation in a cultural interchange of caring for the stranger and the traveler among you. They weren't just being nice. This was their civic duty, so to speak. It's like when RAGBRAI comes through Ames, you don't just let them pass through. You set up water stations and food, and I mean, it's assumed that you care for the people that are wandering through your area. But however we look at this story, we are stuck with and struck by this mystery of the three visitors. And I got to thinking, you know, I wonder if Charles Dickens took inspiration from this story when he wrote The Christmas Carol, right? I mean, there's three spirits that visit Ebenezer Scrooge, Ghost of Christmas Past, Ghost of Christmas Present, and Ghost of Christmas Future. And when the ghost or the spirit of Christmas Past invites Ebenezer to examine his memories, he now sees his story with a new perspective. He's then given the gift of watching in real time the way his past actions have impacted his now strained relationships in life. He then bears witness to a potential imagined future, one where, it's assumed, if he continues to live as he is now, there won't be any strained relationships because he's pushed away everybody else and he's isolated himself. And this story of three spirits is so impactful that we've adapted and modified this tale over numerous decades. The Muppets have even done it, Hulu's done it, Jim Carrey has done a rendition. There's something about the way we continuously seek ways to express our grief of the past and our fear of the future through story. And in fact, our children's stories also include this rule of threes. There's Goldilocks and the three bears. There's the three little pigs. And even in the nursery song, Ba Ba Black Sheep, Have You Any Wool? Three bags full, exactly. And when you go to a wedding or someone's making a toast, when they clink their glasses, it's usually ding, ding, ding. There's usually three clinks. We eat more or less three meals a day. We love the number three. Now, there's this idea of numerology, this study of numbers, that's extremely important in certain Jewish circles. And one of my chaplain colleagues at the hospital, his name is Russell. He's Jewish, and I'm quoting him directly. He's a numbers nerd. He loves numerology. He tried explaining to me the intricacies of numerology, how every letter of the Hebrew alphabet is associated with a number. So when a name is spelled a certain way, the letters add up to a certain number, which then represents something else, and da da da. I got lost. Basically, what I came to understand is that everything has meaning. Every word and image in the Hebrew Bible has meaning and intention. And it's not a setup for a bad joke, like a rabbi and a priest and a nun walk into a house. No, the meaning of the number three cannot, it's not coincidence. There's a reason Abraham and Sarah were visited by three visitors. But when we think about what does the number three mean, we can't fully appreciate it unless we go back and look at the meaning of the number one and the number two. Number one represents unity, peace. Something is undisturbed, unbothered by its nature because it in and of itself is complete. The Shema in Judaism, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. God is unity, God is peace, God is undisturbed. The number two represents discord, tension, opposite sides of the canyon, day over here, night over here. Now, the number three symbolizes a harmony that includes and synthesizes these two opposites. Eliezer Posner says, harmony isn't achieved between numbers one and two by erasing the discord. Instead, the number three honors the value and the purpose of both number one and number two, and it represents a new way forward that includes both of them. I think one of the reasons the Christmas Carol is such a powerful tale of hope and not just terror and grief is because while the past and present may be in tension with one another, the future remains unwritten. There is still an opportunity to make sense of the past and our present. There's still an opportunity for growth and change. Our current cultural conversation sensationalizes the opposites. We relish the divide. We only have two main political parties. We label theology as either conservative or progressive. Our TV ads are filled with before and after photos for people, hair, homes, diets. And these before and afters are often subtly labeled as good and bad. We prefer the either-or thinking because the binary makes sense and it keeps us comfortable. And that's not good or bad, it just is. We even like to read our love of the binary into places where it's not written, and this is what can get us into trouble. We see the creation stories in Genesis and think, day and night, that's it. But when we do this, we ignore the majesty of the evening. If we look for only land and water, we fail to see the mush of sand and creatures that live within the shallows of the tide. We would never hear the rush of the waves lapping against the rocks. Sarah's story is a story of a third way. She was barren, which means she did not have any children, and there was no future possibility of children. But before we got to our story today, she tried to use Hagar as a surrogate with a son. But that didn't work out so well either, and Sarah got upset, so she drove Hagar and Ishmael out of her home. There's a lot of tension in there. The third way opens when the visitors arrive to announce that she will give birth to a son. And because this third way is absurd and laughable, she names her child Laughter. June is Pride Month. This month is an open-ended third way for us. For some of us, it's an opportunity to practice naming where we feel stuck in the binary and practice our own growth, cultivating awareness and making reparations where we've allowed our own comfort of the binary to bring harm to our neighbors. For others, Pride is the starting point. It's the beginning. It is the representation of how we can usher in a more just and equitable world that openly names our diversities and our differences and honors them. I mentioned I currently work at the hospital downtown, and part of my job as a chaplain is responding to the emergency department when traumas come in, either by ambulance or by helicopter. While the medical team, the doctors, the nurses, the techs, they're focused on the healing and the well-being of the body in front of them that has suffered from a car accident, a fall, gunshots, or burns, they're focused on the body. The chaplain's job is to rehumanize the person in our care. Some folks come in without any identification. They are literally the unknown stranger in our midst. So it's our role as chaplains to find any identifying information. We seek out and try to determine if they have family or friends or someone close to them that can come and be with them in the hospital. For folks who come in and are unable to speak for themselves because of their injuries, chaplains reach out to the next of kin, bring them into the hospital, and walk with them as they navigate the decision-making process. Sometimes when the injuries a person sustains are too much for the body to heal, that's when I think the binary is the most cruel. Sometimes these life-sustaining medical interventions like breathing ventilators and organ bypass machines, they make the monitors light up and make it appear as if the body is fully functioning. But when a person is unable to speak on their own behalf, a family member or a beloved is tasked with an impossible decision. If we keep them on the machines, are we adding to their suffering? If we turn off the machines, are we committing an act of murder? There is no win in that either-or thinking. For those who are awake and are able to make their own healthcare decisions, when they're faced with a terrible diagnosis or a poor prognosis and treatment options that would end in pain and debilitation, it seems, again, like a no-win situation. We either give up and I let my family down, or I fight through it and I'm in pain. And I told you, if Charles Dickens had only created two spirits, past and present, it would be a much darker story, be much different. But one of my former chaplain supervisors used to tell us all the time, there are always more than two options. There are always more than two options. And I think perhaps our third option is story, telling our own story. When life-altering things happen, whether it's trauma, tragedy, death, grief, or something joyous, we have to tell the story of what happened to us 150 times for us to be able to integrate it. And so for a moment in time, we become stuck in our own feedback loop of telling and retelling our own story again and again. For example, new parents, myself included, will jump at the opportunity to tell you about the birth process. Minute by minute, play by play. But yes, someone's not in their head. Push by push. It is a lesson in TMI and what not to talk about during a dinner party. But buckle up because it's such a good story, and let me tell you. I witness this often in the emergency department when I listen to families. He was fine this morning. We were eating French toast and everything was fine. He stood up and then everything changed. She went to bed last night. We had a great conversation. She had her tea like always. Everything was fine. I went to check on her this morning, and I knew something was wrong. They tell me once when I first meet them. The doctor comes in and says, "What do you understand about what's happening to your loved one?" And they tell the same thing. "He had French toast this morning. We were fine. We were just finishing our coffee, and then he stood up and everything changed." The nurse comes in to bring them into the room. "He was fine this morning. Everything was great. We had French toast." We repeat again and again. When life breaks us apart and breaks us wide open, story is the only thing that helps us navigate this uncharted territory. It allows us to hold our past. The number one, the unity, the thing that is now undisturbed, because no matter how many times we talk about our past, we cannot change it. That's not good or bad, it just is. The past is now the union of our memories. And then story now allows us to see our present more clearly. It's this episode that shattered what was once a perfect union. We, in telling our story, named the tension of what we thought we knew, everything was fine, with what is. Everything's not fine. But if we stop telling our story, we are left with this tension. We're left unresolved. And we struggle to navigate the tension and the pain. But when we are encouraged to keep telling our story, the community invites us to imagine a future where these two, past and present, are no longer in tension, but they meet, they connect. Telling our story means we don't have to erase the tension or pretend it's not there. We don't even have to fully understand it. But we cannot ignore it. And we can't go around it. We have to go through it. And this work of storytelling isn't done in solitary. It's in the act of sharing our story with others that enables us to return to ourselves. Rather than detaching and disassociating from what was and what is, we allow ourselves to again become human. Sometimes in the emergency department, when I'm able to locate the driver's license of this unknown person, when I'm able to find a name, when I'm able to contact a family member and ask them to come in, I immediately rush back into the trauma bay. I wait for the doctors to pause, and in the middle of maybe they're stitching somebody up or they're gonna do an x-ray, everybody pauses and looks at me for just a moment. But it's long enough for me to share the name of this person, maybe the age, maybe any medical information the family member was able to tell me, any allergies, any past surgeries, or a diagnosis that they recently had. Then they start talking to this unknown person by name. They start comforting them, telling them each and every step what they're doing, reminding them by name, you're safe. We're here to take care of you. Your people are coming. They're on their way. It is extraordinary. The dynamic in the room changes. It's no longer a person we're caring for. It's a beloved. They have a name and a story and a people waiting for them. Story is the thing that rehumanizes us when the circumstances of the world have threatened to strip us of our identities. Story connects us with the community, and story sustains us for the journey. Abraham and Sarah encountered three visitors, an invitation to examine their past, including their own harms that they did to other people. Story invites them to confront their present. Sarah laughing, Abraham pleading with the visitors. And then story invites a chance to construct a more integrated future. So wherever you are on life's journey, when you are face to face with your own three visitors, may you find yourself surrounded by the community to hear your story. May this retelling of your story rehumanize you. May you have the courage to tell it again and again and again until it becomes part of who you are. Amen.